This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception by Scott McClellan. This book is dedicated to those who serve. Preface. The University of Texas has always been special to my family and me. My grandfather, the late Page Keaton, was the legendary dean who led its law school to national prominence. I was born and reared in Austin, Texas, where it is located, and earned an undergraduate degree from the university. I am very familiar with the UT Tower, the main building in the center of campus, with words from the Gospel of John carved in stone above its south entrance. "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." Those powerful words have always piqued my curiosity as a person of faith and as an ordinary human being, keenly interested in the larger meaning of life. But not until the past few years have I come to truly appreciate their message. Perhaps God's greatest gift to us in life is the ability to learn from our experiences, especially our mistakes, and grow into better people. That uniquely human quality is rooted in free will and blossoms in our capacity for knowledge, based on understanding the truth, not as we might imagine or wish it to be, but as it is. And that includes recognizing our faults and accepting responsibility for them. Through contrition, we find the truth and the freedom that comes with it, even as we improve ourselves and grow closer to the image that God our Creator has in mind for us to become. My mother, who began her career in public service as a high school civics and history teacher, likes to say, "It is people, not events, that shape history." She couldn't be more right. History is rooted in the choices made by people, flawed, fallible people. This is a book about the slice of history I witnessed during my years in the White House and about the well-intentioned but flawed human beings, myself included, who shaped that history. I've written it not to settle scores or enhance my own role, but simply to record what I know and what I learned in hopes that my account will deepen our understanding of contemporary history, particularly the events that followed the tragic attacks of September 11, 2001. I began the process of writing this book by putting myself under the microscope. In my efforts on behalf of the presidential administration of George W. Bush, I fell far short of living up to the kind of public servant I wanted to be. Having accepted the post of White House press secretary at age 35 and possessing scant experience of the Washington power game, I didn't fully understand what I was getting myself into. Today, I understand it much better. This book records the often painful process by which I gained that understanding. I frequently stumbled along the way and failed in my duty to myself, to the president I served, and to the American people. I tried to play the Washington game according to the current rules, and at times, didn't play it very well. Because I didn't stay true to myself, I couldn't stay true to others. The mistakes were mine, and I've suffered the consequences. My own story, however, is of small importance in the broad historical picture. More significant is the larger story in which I played a minor role, the story of how the presidency of George W. Bush veered terribly off course. As press secretary, I spent countless hours defending the administration from the podium in the White House briefing room. Although the things I said then were sincere, I have since come to realize that some of them were badly misguided. In these pages, I've tried to come to grips with some of the truths that life inside the White House bubble obscured. My friends and former colleagues who lived and worked or are still living and working inside that bubble may not be happy with the perspective I present here. Many of them, I'm sure, remain convinced that the Bush administration has been fundamentally correct in its most controversial policy judgments, and that the disesteem in which most Americans currently hold it is undeserved. Only time will tell, but I've become genuinely convinced otherwise. The episode that became the jumping-off point for this book was the scandal over the leaking of classified national security information, the so-called Plame affair. It originated in a controversy over the intelligence the Bush administration used to make the case that Saddam Hussein's Iraq represented a grave and gathering danger that needed to be eliminated. When a covert CIA officer's identity was disclosed during the ensuing partisan warfare, turning the controversy into the latest Washington scandal, I was caught up in the deception that followed. It was the defining moment in my time working for the president, and one of the most painful experiences of my life. When words I uttered, believing them to be true, were exposed as false, I was constrained by my duties and loyalty to the president and unable to comment. But I promised reporters and the public that I would someday tell the whole story of what I knew. After leaving the White House, I realized that the story was meaningless without an appreciation of the personal, political, and institutional context in which it took place, so the story grew into a book. Writing it wasn't easy. Some of the best advice I received as I began came from a senior editor at a publishing house that expressed interest in my book. He said the hardest challenge for me would be to keep questioning my own beliefs and perceptions throughout the writing process. His advice was prescient. I found myself constantly questioning my own thinking, my assumptions, my interpretations of events. Many of the conclusions I've reached are quite different from those I would have embraced at the start of the process. The quest for truth has been a struggle for me, but a rewarding one. I don't claim a monopoly on truth, but after wrestling with my experiences over the past several months, I've come much closer to my truth than ever before. Many readers will have come to this book out of curiosity about the man who is a leading character in my story, President George W. Bush. You'll learn about my relationship with him and my experiences as part of his team as you read these pages. For now, let me observe that much of what the general public knows about Bush is true. He is a man of personal charm, wit, and enormous political skill. Like many other people, I was inspired to follow him by his disarming personality and by his record as a popular bipartisan governor who set a constructive tone and got things done for the people. We all hoped and believed he could do the same for the nation. Certainly the seeds of greatness seemed to be present in the Bush administration. Although Bush attained the White House only after an extended legal battle over the outcome of the 2000 election, he began his presidency with considerable goodwill. He commanded a rare, extended period of national unity following the unimaginable national tragedy that struck our nation in September 2001. On paper, the team Bush assembled was impressive. Vice President Dick Cheney was a serious, vastly experienced hand in the top levels of government. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had already enjoyed one successful run at the Pentagon and boasted a resume listing a string of business and government achievements. Secretary of State Colin Powell, an able and widely respected military leader, was easily the most popular public figure in the country and could well have been the first African-American president of the United States had he been interested in the job. Even Bush's chief political advisor, Karl Rove, had a powerful reputation as a brilliant strategic thinker who was helping to make the Republican Party the nation's greatest political force. I believed in George W. Bush's leadership and agenda for America and had confidence in his authenticity, integrity, and judgment. But today, the high hopes that accompanied the early days of his presidency have fallen back to earth. Rumsfeld and Powell are gone, their tenures controversial and disappointing. Vice President Cheney's role is widely viewed as sinister and destructive of the president's legacy, and Rove's reputation for political genius is now matched by his reputation as an operative who places political gain ahead of the national interest. Through it all, President Bush remains very much the same. He is self-confident, quick-witted, down-to-earth, and stubborn as leaders sometimes need to be. His manner is authentic, his beliefs sincere. I never knew Lyndon Johnson, another Texan with a stubborn streak whose domestic accomplishments were overshadowed by a controversial war, or Richard Nixon, a president whose historically low poll ratings following Watergate have been rivaled only by Bush's. But according to historians, both men were consumed with defensiveness, anger, and ultimately anguish as their presidencies unraveled under the pressure of war and scandal, respectively. George W. Bush is different. He is very much the man he always was, though not quite the leader I once imagined him to be. It was the decision to go to war in Iraq that pushed Bush's presidency off course. It was a fateful misstep based on a confluence of events, the shock of 9/11 and our surprisingly and deceptively quick initial military success in Afghanistan, human nature, ambition, certitude, and self-deceit, and a divinely inspired passion, President Bush's deeply held belief that all people have a God-given right to live in freedom. For Bush, removing the grave and gathering danger that Iraq supposedly posed was primarily a means for achieving the far more grandiose objective of reshaping the Middle East as a region of peaceful democracies. History appears poised to confirm what most Americans today have decided, that the decision to invade Iraq was a serious strategic blunder. No one, including me, can know with absolute certainty how the war will be viewed decades from now when we can more fully understand its impact. What I do know is that war should only be waged when necessary, and the Iraq War was not necessary. Waging an unnecessary war is a grave mistake. But in reflecting on all that happened during the Bush administration, I've come to believe that an even more fundamental mistake was made, a decision to turn away from candor and honesty when those qualities were most needed. Most of our elected leaders in Washington, Republicans and Democrats alike, are good and decent people, yet too many of them today have made a practice of shunning truth and the high level of openness and forthrightness required to discover it. Most of it is not willful or conscious. Rather, it is part of the modern Washington game that has become the accepted norm. As I explain in this book, Washington has become the home of the permanent campaign, a game of endless politicking based on the manipulation of shades of truth, partial truths, twisting of the truth, and spin. Governing has become an appendage of politics rather than the other way around, with electoral victory and the control of power as the sole measures of success. That means shaping the narrative before it shapes you. Candor and honesty are pushed to the side in the battle to win the latest news cycle. Of course, deception in politics is nothing new. What's new is the degree to which it now permeates our national political discourse. Much of it is barely noticeable and seemingly harmless, accepted as par for the course. Most of it is done unconsciously or subconsciously with no malicious intent other than to prevail in the increasingly destructive game of power and influence. Some of it is self-deceit. Those engaging in it convince themselves to believe what they are saying, though deep down, they know candor and honesty are lacking. Instead of checking their political maneuvering at the door when the campaign ends, they retain it as part of the way Washington works. The deception it spawns becomes the cancer in our political discourse, greatly damaging the ability of our elected leaders to govern effectively and do what is best for America. Too many politicians and their followers have become passionately committed to a preconceived, partisan view of reality that allows little room for compromise or cooperation with the other side. The gray nuances of truth are lost in the black and white ideologies both parties embrace. Permanent division, gridlock, and a general inability to constructively address the big challenges we all face inevitably follow. President Bush, I believe, did not consciously set out to engage in these destructive practices. But like others before him, he chose to play the Washington game the way he found it, rather than changing the culture as he vowed to do at the outset of his campaign for the presidency. And like others before him, he is engaged in a degree of self-deception that may be psychologically necessary to justify the tactics needed to win the political game. The permanent campaign also ensnares the media, who become complicit enablers of its polarizing effects. They emphasize conflict, controversy, and negativity, focusing not on the real-world impact of policies and their larger underlying truths, but on the horse race aspects of politics, who's winning, who's losing, and why. In exploring this syndrome and the way it helped damage at least one administration, I've tried to contribute to our understanding of Washington's culture of deception and how we, the American people, can change it. Although my time in the Bush White House did not work out as I once hoped, my optimism regarding America has been strengthened. I've met many, many people who are eager for positive change and are ready to devote their lives and energies to the future of our country. I still believe, in the words of then-Governor Bush, that it's possible to show that politics after a time of tarnished ideals can be higher and better. I'm convinced that if we take a clear-eyed look at how our system has gone awry and think seriously about how to fix it, there's nothing we can't achieve. This book, I hope, will contribute to that national conversation. Scott McClellan, April 2008. Chapter 1, A Made for Washington Scandal. Throughout American history, presidential administrations have undergone tumultuous periods of war and scandal. I happened to become White House press secretary at a time when the administration of George W. Bush was going through both, and they were intimately related to each other. In late May 2003, when the president asked me to begin serving as his chief spokesman in July, I did not fully appreciate just how contentious and venomous the atmosphere in Washington was, and how controversial and polarizing the presidency of George W. Bush was about to become. By October, less than 3 months after starting the new job, I was on the front lines defending a White House that was becoming engulfed in a growing scandal on the eve of a re-election campaign that had an increasingly hostile media clamoring and our partisan critics pouncing. For the American public, which had grown weary of the endless investigations and scandals connected with the Clinton presidency, the situation typified the worst of what they saw in Washington. The emerging narrative in the Washington press was that the White House had deliberately blown the cover of Valerie Plame, a covert CIA official. Administration officials had anonymously leaked her identity to reporters in order to punish at worst, or discredit at best, her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who was publicly alleging that the administration had misled the country into war in Iraq. News stories suggested that White House aides had disclosed Plame's identity to at least five reporters. A concerted White House effort to disclose her identity would have meant that the officials involved, knowingly or not, had leaked classified national security information. For nearly 2 weeks following the September 29th disclosure of a criminal investigation by the Department of Justice, I vigorously pushed back at the notion that the White House was behind the leak. Even before then, I had batted down any suggestion that my colleague and fellow Texan Karl Rove, a frequent target of our critics as the president's closest advisor, was involved in the leak. Later, I added the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Louis Scooter Libby, to the list of those I defended. By the daily White House briefing on October 10th, I was looking for a way to extricate myself from commenting any further about specifics of the Plame case, which were now part of the recently announced investigation. The opening I sought came near the end of that Friday's briefing in the form of a question from Victoria Jones, a cordial yet skeptical liberal talk radio journalist and Bush administration critic. "Scott," Jones said, "earlier this week, you told us that neither Karl Rove, Elliot Abrams, nor Louis Libby disclosed any classified information with regard to the leak. I wondered if you could tell us more specifically whether any of them told any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA. I was ready with a reply. "I spoke with those individuals, as I pointed out, and those individuals assured me they were not involved in this," I said. "And that's where it stands." Another reporter seeking clarification jumped in. "They were not involved in what?" "The leaking of classified information," I said. It sounded final and definitive, just as I intended. I'd chosen my words carefully. While I believed what I'd been told by Rove and Libby, I could never know with 100% certainty that it was true, so I purposely put the onus on them, noting that they had assured me about their lack of involvement. It was a firewall of sorts, designed to protect my own credibility if the truth turned out to be more complicated or wholly different from what I'd been told. Not that I expected it to be. After all, I was confident at the time that neither the president nor the vice president would knowingly send me out to mislead the public. The public's assurances I provided that October 10th would be my final comments from the podium denying that Rove and Libby had been involved in the outing of a covert CIA official, and my final comments on any other matters which might be part of the criminal investigation that the leaking of Plame's name had already spawned. There was only one problem. What I'd said was not true. I'd unknowingly passed along false information, and five of the highest-ranking officials in the administration were involved in my doing so. Rove, Libby, Vice President Cheney, the President's Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, and the President himself. For my next 2 years as press secretary, the false words I uttered at that Friday's briefing would stand as the official White House position on the Plame case. Little did I know at the time that what I said and the pervasive deception underlying it would be my undoing as the President's Chief Spokesman. I had allowed myself to be deceived into unknowingly passing along a falsehood. It would ultimately prove fatal to my ability to serve the president effectively. I didn't learn that what I'd said was untrue until the media began to figure it out almost 2 years later. Neither, I believe, did President Bush. He too had been deceived, and therefore became unwittingly involved in deceiving me. But the top White House officials who knew the truth, including Rove, Libby, and possibly Vice President Cheney, allowed me, even encouraged me, to repeat a lie. When the truth finally began to emerge, my credibility as White House spokesman was badly tarnished. A terribly painful experience for me. I blamed myself. I allowed myself to be deceived. But the behavior of the president and his key advisors was even more disappointing. During 2003 and 2004, the White House chose not to be open and forthright on the Plame scandal, but rather to buy time and sometimes even stonewall, using the ongoing investigation as an excuse for silence. The goal was to prevent political embarrassment that might hurt the president and weaken his bid for re-election in November 2004. The motive was understandable, but the behavior was wrong and ultimately self-defeating. And in retrospect, it was all too characteristic of an administration that too often chose in defining moments to employ obfuscation and secrecy rather than honesty and candor. As I reflected on this leak episode, one of the defining episodes of my tenure as press secretary, my view of Washington began to crystallize as never before. What I witness and have come to realize about my time in the spotlight, beyond just this episode, is a larger, very unpleasant truth. The deception was not isolated to one event or even to the Bush White House. It permeates our national political discourse. And while much of the deceit has been incidental and has not been embraced consciously by our elected leaders, it has become an accepted way of winning the partisan wars for public opinion and an increasingly destructive part of Washington's culture. Coming to Washington as a member of a Republican administration, I thought the mentality of political manipulation had been largely the creation of our predecessors in the Clinton White House, and that the leader I placed great hope in, George W. Bush, was dead set on changing it. He chose not to do so. Instead, his own White House became embroiled in political maneuvering that was equally unsavory, if not worse, much of it related directly to his most consequential decision as president, the decision to invade Iraq. So much has been written about the plane leak episode in the past few years that even those of us who were part of its unfolding events have trouble piecing together the crucial details of how it all started. Let me lay them out for you. The explosive controversy that eventually led to the leak scandal began with an assertion about Iraqi efforts to obtain fissile uranium concentrates, so-called yellow cake, from the West African country of Niger. Based on documents that the CIA later acknowledged to be forgeries, this claim was one element of administration efforts in 2002 to demonstrate that the regime of Saddam Hussein was actively seeking to reconstitute its once-abandoned nuclear weapons program and was maintaining a stockpile of biological and chemical weapons. Largely for these reasons, along with the regime's support for terrorism, the president said that Iraq posed a grave and gathering danger to peace in the Middle East, and even to the security of the United States. This argument about WMD was, in turn, the centerpiece of his position that the United States was justified in leading its allies as well as the United Nations toward preemptive war against Iraq. In the fall of 2002, as debate was swirling around Washington and the world over whether or not a war with Iraq was necessary, Congress requested an NIE, a National Intelligence Estimate, about the status of Iraq's WMD program. An NIE represents the collective judgment of all the agencies that make up the U.S. intelligence community. In the NIE of October 2002, entitled Iraq's Continuing Programs for Weapons of Mass Destruction, stated that Iraq had been vigorously trying to procure uranium ore and yellowcake. The yellowcake, a reference to the Niger claim. Based partly on this NIE, Congress voted overwhelmingly and across partisan lines on October 11, 2002, to authorize military action against Iraq by the Commander-in-Chief. The next step in the development of the Niger controversy was the President's 2003 State of the Union Address, which largely focused on the threat posed by Iraq. He delivered the speech as rhetorical and military preparations for an invasion were intensifying and Saddam continued to defy demands from the United Nations Security Council. After talking at some length about the Iraq regime's continued pursuit of chemical and biological weapons, as well as its ties to terrorism, the president briefly and ominously alluded to the greatest fear-provoking claim that the regime was moving forward on an advanced nuclear weapons program. The president had already stated that Iraq could build a nuclear bomb within a year if it acquired necessary fissile material, such as uranium. Now he uttered what would become known as the 16 words, his first personal reference to the Niger uranium claim. The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Those 16 words would become the nexus of the controversy that delivered a near fatal blow to the credibility of the president and his administration. As the push toward war continued, President Bush and others in his administration continued to make the case for action against Iraq. Because of Secretary of State Colin Powell's enormous bipartisan popularity, as well as his unquestioned honor and integrity, the White House recognized that he would be the most logical and persuasive person to help seal the case at home and abroad. So on February 5th, Powell made a special presentation before the UN Security Council concerning the Iraqi effort to develop and stockpile weapons of mass destruction. This presentation did not include the Africa claim. after carefully scrutinizing the intelligence. Pal had chosen not to use it, a decision that in retrospect was both wise and highly revealing. Still, that claim remained in the public mind one of the most potent bits of evidence in the administration's case for war. After all, the threat of nuclear attack by Iraq seemed far more frightening to most Americans than the more remote danger of a chemical or biological attack on U.S. soil. That is why the words of National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice on September 8th had made headlines. The problem here is that there will always be some uncertainty about how quickly Saddam can acquire nuclear weapons, but we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Then, just as America was on the verge of war, the Niger claim was seriously undermined. On March 7, 2003, days before the president launched Operation Iraqi Freedom to disarm and topple Saddam's regime, Mohammed el-Baradei, the director general of the UN's Nuclear Inspection and Verification Arm, IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, made a startling statement and remarks to the Security Council. The Iranian intelligence was not credible, and there was no evidence or plausible indication that Iraq had revived a nuclear weapons program. Furthermore, he implied that the documents on which the Niger claim had been based were forgeries. Based on thorough analysis, the IAEA has concluded with the concurrence of outside experts that these documents, which form the basis for the report of recent uranium transaction between Iraq and Niger, are in fact not authentic. We have therefore concluded that these specific allegations are unfounded. 2 days later, Secretary Powell was asked about el-Baradei's remarks by Tim Russert on NBC's Meet the Press. In response, Powell stated that the uranium information was provided in good faith, and if it turned out to be wrong, then fine. But he asserted to Russert that it was still an open issue to be investigated. Then he went on to restate another key administration talking point about how we had previously underestimated Iraq's nuclear capabilities. "We have to be a little careful about nuclear weapons programs," Powell warned. "We saw the IAEA almost give Iraq a clean bill of health in the early 1990s, only to discover that they had a robust nuclear weapons program that they had not discovered." Powell was correct that intelligence reporting had previously underestimated the threat from Saddam Hussein's regime. His remark underscored many officials' lack of trust in the UN Nuclear Inspection Agency, which some White House and administration officials used to convince themselves with an overabundance of certitude that the Iraqi regime was a real and growing threat in a post-9/11 world. In any case, doubts about the accuracy of the Niger claim did little to slow the momentum toward military confrontation. On March 19th, the war with Iraq began. In a March 31st New Yorker article, Seymour Hersh discussed the Niger documents and flatly called them forgeries. Though Hersh was known for his liberal views and therefore discounted by many on the conservative side of the political spectrum, he was also considered by the mainstream media to be a diligent reporter with good contacts in the policy arena, and his article shone a spotlight on doubts about the Niger documents. The idea that the Bush administration might have based part of its argument for a controversial war on inaccurate intelligence was one thing. Most Americans would be inclined to forgive an honest mistake, especially if it stemmed from an excess of caution about a perceived threat in a dangerous post-9/11 world. But if administration leaders deliberately chose to ignore the facts when assembling the case for war, and even worse, if they knowingly dissembled in order to make the case appear stronger than it was, Americans might not be so forgiving. That was the new, far more potent charge leveled in a New York Times opinion piece written in May 2003 by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Iraq War opponent Nicholas Kristof. In his column, Missing in Action Truth, Kristof drew on information provided by an anonymous, albeit credible, source to suggest that the administration had deliberately misled the nation into war. An unnamed, former U.S. ambassador to Africa told Kristof that he had been sent to Niger to answer questions from the vice president's office about Iraq seeking uranium. Kristof wrote that the unnamed envoy reported to the CIA and State Department that the information was unequivocally wrong and that the documents had been forged. The envoy's debunking of the forgery was passed around the administration and seemed to be accepted, except that President Bush and the State Department kept citing it anyway. They were tough words, written by a prominent liberal columnist for what many consider the national newspaper of record. Doubts about the veracity of the Niger claim had been around for a long time, but Kristof was now suggesting something far more sinister. that the administration had cited the uranium claim, knowing it was unequivocally wrong. The specific accusation being made by Kristof and his unnamed source fed into a broader, already burgeoning controversy over how the White House had used intelligence to make the case to Congress and the public for justifying going to war in Iraq. As U.S. forces swept through Iraq, the discovery almost everyone expected them to make, large WMD stockpiles, was failing to materialize. In response, administration critics, particularly the more partisan ones, were starting to charge that the president had deliberately misled the nation by exaggerating or hyping the intelligence to justify war. At best, critics of the Iraq War believed that the president had not been straight with the American people. They believed that he and his advisors had likely ignored or disregarded caveats and contradictory evidence about the intelligence to make the threat from Iraq seem more serious than it really was, and thereby create a sense of urgency and gain necessary public backing. While Kristof's column did not generate much immediate interest from the national media, it did get noticed by the White House, particularly the vice president and his office. And not unlike the Clinton White House, which quickly and aggressively countered criticisms, the Bush White House began taking steps to aggressively fight back. The vice president, whose credibility and integrity were specifically being questioned, and his office would take a leading role in these efforts, beginning in late May 2003. Through inquiries at the State Department, the vice president's office quickly learned the identity of Kristof's unnamed source. It was former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who'd been sent to Niger to investigate the uranium allegation in January 2002. Under the cloak of anonymity, the vice president and trusted aide, Scooter Libby, soon began an effort to discredit Wilson with selected journalists. Unknown to anyone else in the compartmentalized, internally secretive White House, including the White House Chief of Staff, the National Security Advisor, and the CIA director, the president declassified key portions of information from the October 2002 NIE for the vice president and Libby to use in this effort. At the same time, Libby and other high-ranking administration officials, including Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, Karl Rove, and then-Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, would anonymously share another piece of classified national security information, the identity of Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, and her role as a CIA employee in helping to arrange Wilson's investigative trip to Niger. The purpose of these leaks was to discredit Wilson by undermining his public assertions that he had been sent to Niger by the CIA at the vice president's request. But the circle of those who knew about these leaks was very small, and some of those who participated didn't even realize that Plame's identity was a state secret. These decisions, to defend the president and to launch a stealth campaign to discredit Joe Wilson and expose his wife's CIA role as part of that campaign, would have profound long-term implications for the credibility of the Bush administration. As the effort to discredit Wilson was getting underway, I was still deputy press secretary. I had just been tapped to replace Ari Fleischer, who'd announced his intent to leave in the middle of July. So my duties were still focused elsewhere, and therefore I had no knowledge of the anonymous efforts to expose Plame and discredit Wilson. The 16 words controversy was still taking shape and did not grow legs until early July 2002, about a week before I assumed my new position. At the time, like others in the White House, I viewed Wilson's assertions as a malicious attack with partisan overtones. I knew of no real justification for questioning the case for war and felt no reason to question it myself. I trusted the key members of the president's team, and I had no reason to doubt the president's integrity. Of course, I realized that the administration was engaged in some back-and-forth jockeying with critics on Capitol Hill and in the press about the pre-war intelligence and the case for war. But I felt it was all part of the modern-day Washington game, a permanent campaign between two sides, each trying to shape and manipulate public approval. As far as I knew, we were simply doing what we had to do, fighting back against unsubstantiated, malicious charges that the president had knowingly lied in order to take the nation to war. The partisan warfare of the 1990s was once again taking center stage, and the media were all too eager to cover who was winning and who was losing. Clouded in controversy once again were the larger underlying truths, including how the White House had made the case for war. The resulting drama of secrecy and deception, of charges and countercharges, was playing out in the theater of political power, Washington, D.C., and I found being part of the play exciting. While politics had been a focus of my life for as long as I could remember, I never imagined one day being cast as a prominent supporting actor in such a widely watched and historically significant drama. Chapter 2. A Small Part of Something Grand. There's an idealistic streak in many of us who get involved in politics. We have a longing for a great leader, the one we imagine is the mythical president of strong character, free of debilitating personal flaws, and committed to striving for high ideals and bringing about something as close to Camelot as we can get, where truth, goodness, and beauty reign supreme. Most of us are also grounded enough in reality to recognize that such a superhuman leader exists only in our imagination. Yet we still hope for the rare leader who possesses extraordinary talents, unique charisma, and a firm commitment both to striving for greatness and to achieving it the right way, honestly and nobly. Our history immortalizes such rarities of leadership. Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln watch over our nation's capital from their gigantic memorials of stone. Their granite heads, along with Teddy Roosevelt's, gaze out from Mount Rushmore, symbolizing the ideals of America: freedom, democracy, hope, and opportunity for people from all walks of life. Martin Luther King Jr. is revered in memory for challenging America to live up to its ideals of equality and justice for all. While I did not view George W. Bush as the most charismatic or awe-inspiring leader in the world when I went to work for him, I believed he possessed enough of those qualities to be a very good, if not great, president. I also believed he had a rare understanding of what everyday citizens across America were looking for in a leader, and was committed to giving it to them. Consequently, in January 1999, when Governor Bush asked me to join his team, I was filled with excitement. I was sitting and waiting, a little nervously, in the wood-framed communications office with its high ceiling inside the pink-domed Texas State Capitol building. Karen Hughes came back in and said, "The governor is ready to see you." As I entered the large, ornate reception area outside the governor's office, I put on my game face. My mind went into tunnel vision focus, as it used to do in my competitive tennis days, when in a moment of peak performance, I could block out all the distractions around me, the people, the wind, the noise, and focus completely on the ball in the court. I could feel my adrenaline flowing. I was confident and anxious at the same time. It was a special moment. I enjoyed my place in Texas politics, and had never felt the pull of Washington. I found the partisan warfare that dominated national politics for much of the 1990s tiresome and off-putting. But I knew this offer from George W. Bush was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be a small part of something grand. It was the equivalent in sports of joining a football team that has a real shot at winning the Super Bowl, and perhaps even at going down as one of the great teams in history. Given Bush's performance as governor of Texas, I thought he had the potential to change Washington and accomplish some big things. And while I was only committing to working in the governor's office, I knew in the back of my mind that the opportunity to follow him to Washington would likely be an option should he run for president, as all expected he would, and prevail. Karen Hughes was Bush's longtime communications director, and she and I had already talked about my joining Bush's team as a senior spokesman in his gubernatorial office. Now it was time for him to sign off on her recommendation. Bush and I had known each other since his first run for governor and my early days as a young Texas political strategist, though not on much of a personal level. Officially, he had not yet decided to enter the presidential race, but everyone knew, even if those inside Team Bush did not say so out loud, that he would soon begin implementing a well-developed plan to do so. His chief political advisor, Karl Rove, was already deep into strategic planning for a national campaign. Soon, Karen Hughes, his most trusted communicator, would move to join the Presidential Exploratory Committee, leaving behind an experienced deputy and senior spokesman, Linda Edwards, who had solid journalistic credentials but lacked a background in politics. Linda would be elevated to communications director in the governor's office, while the position I was looked at to fill would be that of deputy communications director. Karen had reached out to me to fill the void that would be created by her approaching departure. Since Bush was expected to enter the sweepstakes for the White House as the frontrunner, given his family name and his success as Texas governor, he and his gubernatorial record and policies would come under intense scrutiny by the national media. Karen wanted to make sure his government communications office, which would be on the receiving end, had the political experience and sensitivity needed to handle the expected onslaught of national media interest. Only weeks earlier, Reggie Basher, a savvy Texas political strategist who had mentored me through three winning statewide campaigns I'd managed, had said, "You've been noticed by the governor's people. They're looking for a senior spokesman with political experience. They want to talk with you if you're interested." It was only a few days after my job overseeing my mother's underdog campaign in the hotly contested 1998 race for the powerful Texas comptroller's office had ended in her surprising victory, and I had not really thought about what was next for me. Nepotism laws prevented me from following Mom into her new office. My immediate focus was on helping her transition into her new duties, managing one of the larger state office staffs, controlling the state's purse strings, including its more than $80 billion biennial budget, making revenue estimates on the cost of legislation, and certifying how much money lawmakers could spend, among other things. The goal was to help her assemble a trusted team of senior advisors. Reggie Basher was dangling a very tempting proposition. I was humbled by Reggie's words. I liked the governor. He always seemed approachable and down-to-earth, and came across as genuine when we visited. I thought highly of his style of bipartisan leadership and the outstanding team he had assembled to advance his agenda, but I had never imagined becoming a part of it. Members of Bush's team were understatedly bright, outwardly humble, and they seemed committed to serving something larger than their own interest, probably the reason they all seemed to work well with one another. Being one of them meant belonging to the top political talent in the state. Working for Bush was the pinnacle of Texas politics. Now, walking into Bush's office at the dawn of a new legislative session following his landslide re-election as governor, I felt a deep sense of humility and gratitude. Why, I wondered, was I, of all people, being sought out by the popular Texas governor who might well be the next U.S. president? The large rectangular office was dimly lit, with the governor's desk at one end and his collection of autographed baseballs on the other. Near the baseballs were positioned a couch, a couple of chairs, and a coffee table. A portrait of the legendary Sam Houston, president of the Republic of Texas and governor of Texas after it joined the Union, showed him wearing a toga and a laurel crown in the style of an ancient Roman Caesar. Not the way most Texans would ever picture their governor, particularly in the early years of statehood. Bush used to have fun at his legendary successor's expense by referring to the painting as a lesson for political leaders to be careful about what they agree to do. The governor leaned back in his chair, one knee crossed. It was a typically relaxed posture I would see many a time in the years ahead. "How you doing, Scott?" Bush asked good-naturedly. "Have a seat." "Good, Governor," I responded. "I'm honored to be here." He said I was there because my talents had been noticed. We chatted a little about my mother and her election race, and he complimented me for managing a well-run campaign. "I just stayed out of her way," I said. "That was smart," he chuckled, knowing what I meant. My mother is a dynamic type A personality with boundless energy, not unlike the woman who was seeking to bring me onto Bush's team. The biggest difference is that Karen is about a foot taller than my mother, who is barely 5 feet tall. I'd already playfully told Karen that going to work for her would be no problem since her personality was so similar to my mother's. Both are strong, charismatic women who are go-getters and talk rather fast. Bush always had a fondness for strong women, my mother included. He liked her energy, enthusiasm, and straight talk, and he liked her feistiness and toughness. She was elected to a state office at the same time Bush was first elected governor, and they had been friends ever since. As for me, I'm about as reserved as Mom is animated, but I would not have been sitting where I was that day if she had not called on me to help her career in state politics. "Why do you want to work for me?" the governor inquired right off the bat. "Because I believe in you," I said. "It's not about me," Bush jumped in. "It's about the agenda." "Yes, sir, you're right," I said. "That's what I mean. I believe in your agenda, and I believe in your leadership. I admire the way you have reached out across the aisle to get things done." I went on to express how I thought people of my generation were tired of the political bickering at the national level and wanted leaders who could rise above partisanship, something Bush was doing in Texas, even as Washington was moving in the opposite direction. We talked about his governing style, the positive tone he worked to set, his broader agenda, and how he had surrounded himself with some of the best and brightest in Texas to serve on his team. Bush talked passionately about his agenda and his focus on achieving results. It was his strong belief, he said, that government programs which served a legitimate purpose should be made to achieve their intended results. More broadly, underlying his belief that it's about the agenda was a lesson he had learned in politics, primarily from following his father's presidency. Results matter most. People judge leaders, and history remembers them based on their success more than anything else. In time, I would come to learn that in Bush's view of national politics, it mattered far less to the public how a leader achieved those results, whether with or without broad bipartisan support, and whether or not one was fully open and forthright in achieving them. As long as programs prove successful, the public tends to remember only the end results, not how leaders went about reaching them. As we began forging a long-term bond, grounded in our working relationship and our shared affection for Texas, I didn't yet appreciate just how much that view would predominate, for better and worse, in Bush's approach to governing once he arrived in Washington. Then he mentioned some of his expectations for his spokespeople, the importance of staying on message, the need to talk about what you're for, rather than what you are against. How he liked to make the big news on his own time frame and terms without his spokespeople getting out in front of him. and finally making sure that public statements were coordinated internally so that everyone is always on the same page and there are few surprises. I haven't made a decision about whether I will run for president, Bush added. I'm still thinking about it, but you have good political instincts, and I'll need your help watching out for me in this office if I start to test the ground. I told him I understood, and he wrapped up the conversation. We had clicked. I'd made no fatal mistakes. I was hired. Everything seemed pretty good to me at that moment. Here I was, joining the team of an accomplished leader with a proven ability to calm the partisan waters, bring people together, and achieve positive results. I had no reason to anticipate serious disappointment over the horizon. I was 30 years old at the time. Having grown up around politics on the local level in the capital city of Texas and having worked on the state level for nearly a decade, I knew politics often turns into a contact sport. Elections could be mean-spirited, but watching Washington during the 1990s was like watching the final weeks of a hotly contested political campaign that had turned wearily negative and was now being played out endlessly on television 24/7. Deliberation and compromise, elements central to governing, particularly in a constitutional representative democracy, all but disappeared. Who had the best ideas or policies mattered little compared to who was winning the battle for public opinion. Conflict, controversy, and negativity received growing emphasis in the media, and voices of partisanship and ideology grabbed increasingly more attention than voices of consensus and reason and pragmatism. As a Republican, I tended to view Democrats as more shrill and unfair in their tactics, but it was abundantly clear that both parties shared the blame for the deteriorating climate in Washington, where elections might be held, but the campaigning never stopped. The Clinton presidency had taken the art of successful campaigning to new, unparalleled levels. It had begun during the 1992 election, when the Clinton team, led by the colorful duo of George Stephanopoulos and James Carville, vowed not to allow their candidate to be mocked, belittled, and humiliated as Michael Dukakis had been in 1988. Campaigning with an effective aggressiveness shown by few Democrats in recent years, they captured the White House for their party for only the second time in 7 elections. Unfortunately, once inside the White House, the Clinton administration maintained much the same partisan, chip-on-the-shoulder posture, cynically employing spin, rapid response, obfuscation, dissembling, and bare-knuckle tactics to discredit those who challenged it openly. Meanwhile, Republicans in Congress, led by Newt Gingrich, stung by their loss of the presidency, responded in kind. They sought to wrest political power out of the president's hands by pushing an ideologically driven agenda, tearing down Clinton and attacking congressional Democrats rather than reaching out to forge common ways forward in line with their political priorities. Some of what the Gingrich Republicans did was simply smart political positioning, as when they developed and trumpeted their contract with America as a coherent agenda and set of shared talking points for congressional candidates to rally around. The gambit helped them wrest control of the House of Representatives from the Democrats in 1994. But some of what they did was based on exaggerated charges of dishonesty, immorality, and corruption, using Washington scandal culture as a weapon to attack Clinton and his allies. The parade of scandals seemed endless. Travelgate, Whitewater, FBI Gate, the Vince Foster case, the Rose Law Firm billing records affair, and of course, the Monica Lewinsky episode. In the eyes of history, some of these scandals will probably seem insignificant, others disturbing, but less than earth-shattering. But their effect on politics in the 1990s is indisputable. Zero-sum politics became the rule. There could be only winners and losers. For the media, it was all about who was up and who was down. For elected leaders, the truth behind the storyline mattered less than being on the offensive, shaping the narrative to your political advantage with the American people, or defensively responding to it. And as I think this book will show, there's a direct line between the attitude that truth is secondary to political victory and the obfuscation, dissembling, and lack of intellectual honesty that helped take our country into the war in Iraq. But in Texas during the 1990s, something different was going on. A popular Republican governor is working closely with a Democratic lieutenant governor and a Democratic Speaker of the House to produce legislation and policies that met the needs and satisfied the desires of the majority of the state's people, whether conservative or liberal. In large part because of Democratic Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock's influence and Bush's keen grasp of Texas politics, there was little animosity between the leaders of the executive and legislative branches of government. It was not about who received credit for the results. Playing politics during the legislative session was viewed as unacceptable and was not tolerated. Governing was less about persuading or selling the public and more about deliberating and compromising to serve the best interest of Texas. Most state leaders believed they had been elected to do that, and they worked to uphold their end of the bargain. As soon as he was elected governor, Bush reached out to Democratic leaders, including the powerful Bullock, hoping to govern in a bipartisan manner. In Texas, the governor and lieutenant governor are elected separately. Bullock had deep roots in Texas government, having previously served 4 terms as the influential Texas comptroller. The Texas Constitution placed great power in the lieutenant governor as head of the Texas Senate, where he appointed committee chairpersons and determined the flow of legislation, directly influencing whether bills were passed or killed. Bullock's forceful personality, as large as Texas, made him even more effective than the average lieutenant governor. For all these reasons, Bush knew that building trust and a close relationship with Bullock, as well as with the Democratic Speaker, Pete Laney, would be integral to getting his priorities passed. The three spoke frequently and met routinely at least once a week during session. By all accounts, Bush established far more collegial relations with Bullock and Laney than his Democratic predecessor, Ann Richards, had done. Bush also reached out and built relationships with other Democratic leaders in the legislature, particularly, but not exclusively, key committee chairs. It was not unusual for Bush to stop by a member's office unannounced for a visit, and when election time came, Bush did not campaign against incumbent Democratic leaders who worked with him and helped advance his priorities. This nonpartisan approach paid real dividends. During his first session, Bush managed to pass the largest revision of the state's education code in decades, strengthen juvenile justice laws, and implement reforms in regard to both welfare and lawsuits, core issues during his campaign for governor. To me, leadership means uniting people around a common purpose, rather than dividing them along ideological lines, and I found Governor Bush's leadership inspiring. He adroitly joined forces with Bullock and Laney to build and sustain a strongly bipartisan, collegial approach to governing. Could his leadership usher in a new political dynamic on the national level too, as it had in Texas? Many younger people were looking for just such a change. After all, shouldn't politics be about something higher and better than what our leaders in Washington were delivering? With the right presidential leadership, couldn't our elected leaders learn to set aside the excesses of perpetual campaigning and scorched earth politics and work together to serve our nation's best interests? Like many other Americans, I believe they could. I always viewed politics as a way to make a positive difference for the common good, a belief that had been instilled in me early in life. It was for that reason, as much as any other, that I chose a career in the field. And George W. Bush, I genuinely believed, just might embody what I and so many others were seeking, a leader who could make us believe that it would be worthwhile to go to Washington after all, to see if we could change the destructive dynamic that dominated it during the 1990s. As governor, Bush focused on big issues with broad appeal that affected all Texans. When it came to controversial issues like abortion, for example, he sought to find common ground by identifying practical ways to reduce the number of abortions, such as supporting parental notification and promoting adoption. He did not expend effort on divisive, narrow issues, tailor his words to please a particular group of people, or strive to pit groups of people against one another for political gain. His popularity in Texas spanned the spectrum of Democrats, Independents, and Republicans. With an approval rating reaching well into the 70s, Bush attracted broad support for his leadership, policies, and governance. It was a solid record of bipartisan accomplishment that he would highlight during his presidential campaign. Our campaign slogans captured what was unique about Bush. He was a uniter, not a divider, a different kind of Republican from the hard-edged, confrontational Gingrich and his group. He offered a compassionate conservative agenda and a commitment to change the bitter tone in Washington by bringing Republicans and Democrats together to solve the big problems. Bush's principled leadership, bipartisan record, and compassionate conservative agenda inspired much hope in me and those whom I would soon call colleagues, fellow members of the Bush team. And that's why I was there, seizing a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be part of something grand, because I believe that politics could be something far better than politics as usual. No wonder I was both thrilled and humbled at being hired to work for George W. Bush. Chapter 3. Growing up in politics. Many people choose to get involved in politics as student activists in college, as young citizens involved in civic affairs, or as middle-aged people concerned with their community. A few, like me, are born with politics in their blood. I've been involved with politics in one way or another for as long as I can remember. My mother was a trailblazer for women in politics. In 1972, when I was 4 years old, she was elected to the Austin School Board. A few years later, she became the first woman president of the board. By the time I was nearing the end of third grade, She was elected the first woman mayor of Austin and would win election to an unprecedented 3 2-year terms. I remember going to a U.S. mayor's conference in Atlanta, Georgia with my mother and older twin brothers during her first term in the late 1970s. The conference always featured chaperone children's events while the elected officials participated in meetings. Among other outings, we got to go to Six Flags Over Georgia. As a kid, I always loved the thrill of a roller coaster. Little did I know what good preparation that was for someone who would enter politics. My older brothers were a little less adventurous. I'm not trying to imply any wimp factor here, or perhaps less willing to wait in a long line for a 2-minute adrenaline high. So I was left waiting by myself in line for the new double-loop mind bender. As I stood there, wearing my big name tag with the U.S. Mayor's Conference logo, a college student the size of an offensive lineman looked down at it and asked, "So your dad's mayor of Austin?" All of 10 years old and oblivious to how unusual my mother's accomplishment was in those years, I replied matter-of-factly, "No, my mother is." The guy was stunned and yelled ahead to his buddies, "Hey guys, get this, this kid's mother is mayor of Austin." I turned a bit red at receiving this unsought attention in the roller coaster line, though not enough to keep me from sharing a little more with them about one of my heroes, my mom. It was an early political lesson for a kid who thought little about the significance of my mayor's gender or how unusual it was in those days for a political leader to be a woman. To me, she was the high-energy supermom who packed school lunches, fixed dinner when she could, drove me to my tennis matches, attended my Little League games, helped me with school projects, paid for my hamburger and fries at the neighborhood Holiday House restaurant, disciplined my brothers and me when we misbehaved, let me play in her office or the back of council chambers, hauled me along to receptions, way too many I would add, and happened to run a big city the rest of the time. And during most of her time as mayor, Mom was a single parent. It all seemed normal to me in my preteen years. Only now do I fully appreciate what a remarkable woman my mother was and is. My mother and father divorced when I was 10. Back then, I did not understand why. My dad, an attorney, was a good father to me in those innocent years, but we grew apart as the years went by. Like most kids, I've got warm memories of my dad, clinging to his chest hairs when he would playfully pretend to drop me, at age 4 or 5, into the blue waters of a swimming pool's deep end, holding me up in his arms, walking into the darkness of our front yard as he pointed out the Big Dipper or the stars of Orion, telling a story from Greek mythology, or helping coach my Little League baseball team. But after the divorce, the times we talked and spent together grew shorter and farther apart. Nowadays, we see or talk to each other very infrequently, but he is still the dad I know, fondly recall, and will always unconditionally love. My brothers and I were blessed to be close to all 4 of our grandparents, and they influenced us in a tremendously positive way as we were coming of age. Grandma McClellan, who volunteered at the church thrift store and taught Spanish to kindergartners in San Antonio, liked to spoil us and let us have fun. She raised 4 daughters and a son, my father, while Grandpop worked as a petroleum engineer, among the first to graduate from the University of Texas with a degree in the field. He was a good man of slender build and few words who grew up in small-town Texas. He enjoyed spending spare time with family, working in the yard of their modest house in San Antonio, and listening to Texas Longhorn football and baseball games on the radio he kept next to his recliner. His hearing wasn't great in his later years, but just being around him was nice. While Granddad Keaton taught the law, as Mom likes to say, in our family, Grandmom Keaton was the law. Grandmom Keaton came to the University of Texas in the early 1930s from the University of Georgia in her hometown of Atlanta to attend the law school. She was enrolled in Granddad's class. He was a young professor who had recently graduated from the law school, and one thing led to another. Grandmom never quite finished law school. She looked after my brothers and me quite a bit, keeping us in line and making sure we knew our manners. My granddad, Page Keaton, a legendary dean of the University of Texas Law School, always had a great wit about him. He and Grandmom were married on March 4th, or as Granddad used to quip, 2 days after Texas gained its independence, I lost mine. Instead of referring to how many years they had been married, he talked about how they had gone 63 rounds when celebrating their anniversary. But the two were inseparable. To this day, I tear up when thinking about the time I took Granddad to visit my ailing grandmother in the hospital. She had been there for a few days, while he, aging and frail, unable to get around without the help of a wheelchair or walker, had been stuck at home worrying about his lifelong sparring partner. I set him down in the chair next to Grandmom's hospital bed. She was unable to sit up the day we visited. I noticed Granddad, using all his strength, starting to rock himself forward in the chair. He was trying to push himself up, and I grabbed under his arms to help him. He had one focus, my grandmother. Now standing and shaking a little, using every bit of his strength, he leaned down with some help from me to kiss her and said, "I love you, Madge." I hope you come home soon. In that moment, I thought, that's what it's all about. Here is this accomplished man of great intellect and strong character, and what matters most to him in these final years is not all he achieved in his profession, but all he shared with the family in which he instilled so much good. Granddad grew up in northeast Texas on a small farm. After picking cotton in his early years in Red River County, he vowed to have a sit-down job when he was older. He found it along with a lectern at the University of Texas Law School. Not long after he worked his way through school, he worked his way into a professorship. He ended up teaching all the way to age 86. He served 25 years as the dean of the law school and built it into one of the finest in the nation. He came to be known as one of the leading experts on tort law in the country. A favorite story about my granddad was told to me by a family friend and a UT law school graduate several years ago, not long after my grandfather passed away. This friend had been in a pre-law class that granddad spoke to. My granddad, standing at the podium in the theater-style classroom, looked over his glasses resting on his nose and asked students if they knew what made a good lawyer. One student toward the back of the room jumped up and said, "Dean Keaton, I believe right is right and wrong is wrong, and I believe in good over evil. Do you think I will make a good lawyer?" Without missing a beat, my granddad peered up at the student and replied, "No, but you'll make a good Batman," to lots of laughter in the room. I thought how much that sounded like the man I knew, who had a great, witty way of making a point. My granddad was teaching the students that the law is not always black and white, nor should a lawyer view it that way. The truth tends to involve plenty of nuance and shades of gray. My granddad's class was often referred to by students as Keaton's Comedy Hour. But he was also renowned for his enormous knowledge of the law and his influence in shaping it for the better. To those in his profession who knew him and learned from him, Granddad was more than a good man. He was a great man, to be respected, admired, and emulated. Some of my favorite times with Granddad and Grandmom were attending University of Texas football games. They had 4 tickets in the faculty section, and I usually brought a friend along. I started attending UT football games at an early age in the 1970s, and warmly remember the days of Heisman Trophy winner Earl Campbell and our national title runs that fell short. UT football was part of our family life, and it became an inseparable part of my life, too. Back in the 1950s and early 1960s, my granddad used to kick himself. For a brief period before becoming dean of the UT Law School, he was hired as dean of the law school at the University of Oklahoma.